Hey, true crime fans, have you listened to Wine and Crime yet?
We're a true crime comedy podcast hosted by three childhood friends who chug wine, chat true crime, and unleash our worst Minnesotan accents.
Each week, us gals pick a true crime topic and pair it with a delicious wine before delving into the background and psychology behind the crime.
Then we share and speculate wildly about a couple of bonkers cases related to the topic.
Past episodes include necrophilia, cults, crimes of passion, cruise ship disappearances, exorcisms gone wrong, all this over a bottle of wine, or, let's be real, three.
Listen anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Wine and Crime Pod, and check out our website and blog at wineandcrimepodcast.com.
Cheers!
Hi, this is Mike Byrne, and I'm the moderator of the Facebook group The Chicago Outfit, old and current news articles, and you're listening to the Gangland Wire.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on a donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jinx Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers. We're here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
And we have our Chicago connection, shall we say, our man in Chicago, Mike Byrne. Welcome, Mike. Mike has a Facebook page. Then the subject of that Facebook page is the Chicago Outfit. He has nothing but Chicago Outfit articles that are posted on it. He does four or five every day, sometimes seven or eight every day, and they're all interesting. They're all good. He'll have real deal Chicago Outfit guys make comments on it. He's got Red Womet, real deal Chicago Outfit former associate, shall we say, who was part of it, and will straighten you out. If you ask a question, or you make some stupid statement about the outfit, you don't know what you're talking about, he'll straighten them out. Or if you got a question, he'll answer the question. Right, Mike?
Correct, yeah. Yep, Red Womet's great. Yeah, he's added so much to the group.
Yeah, tell the folks the name of that Facebook page.
It's called the Chicago Outfit Old and Current News Articles.
And it's a good one, folks. So tonight we're going to go back and we're going to finish the fourth and final episode on Harry the Hook Edelman, Chicago Outfit enforcer, maybe the most feared enforcer and hitman of the 1970s, which says something, because they had some bad dudes up there. And Butch Petrocelli, his partner, and part of his little crew. Is that the crew they called the Wild Bunch?
Yeah, the Wild Bunch. Yeah, Harry, Butch Petrocelli, Jimmy Anandino, Gerald Scarpelli, Jerry Scalise, and James Duke Baselli. They were all... Every one of those guys besides James Baselli were all notorious killers for the outfit.
Well, so they were the Taylor Street crew?
Yeah, they were tied. Yeah, they were tied in with the Taylor Street crew. Yeah, and through Joe Ferriola.
Yeah, that's what I remember. And Joe Ferriola kind of moved on up in the mob after, kind of based on all their success, to underboss, I believe, didn't he?
Yeah, he moved up. Yeah, once Iupa and Cerrone and those guys went to trial and prison for this casino skimming, Ferriola got bumped up. And some say he was boss, but others say he was underboss, and Sam Carlisi was the boss. But yeah, he was definitely the underboss at the time of the convictions of Joey Iupa and Jackie Cerrone.
Yeah, and when you say that about Jackie Cerrone and Iupa going to jail for the skim, that happened right here in Kansas City. They used to be going, there's a bunch
Correct.
Of images on Facebook here recently of them walking out of the front of the courthouse with Tony Splatro was with them at the time, and he ended up getting his trial case separated.
A short video clip.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're walking out with their lawyers, one at a time and speaking with each other. And which is ironically, because you think about what happened a few months, probably about a few months after that video, Splatro was murdered on orders of Iupa and Cerrone. So it's kind of ironic that all three men are leaving together, and Tony's sitting here not really, probably, he knew he was in trouble, but he probably had no idea what lay ahead for him.
Yeah, really. So a little recap. Harry Edelman grew up in Chicago in the kind of the northwest side of close to downtown, where kind of a little Italy section. His mother was the sister to his later outfit boss, Joe Ferriola, a guy we were just talking about. His father was Mexican. He was kind of a small-time Mexican gangster. Did a little time when Harry was little. He was extremely violent and sadistic with his children. Harry talked about later on in a probation interview that his father beat him almost every day with some kind of a leather strap or something like that. And what's interesting about Harry Edelman is he turned around and became almost the ideal father for stepchildren. As an adult, the children all still love him. I know, Mike, you've had contact with the one daughter that's written a book, and she just thinks he can do no wrong, and the government was all wrong for going after him.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, I've spoken to her several times through Facebook and stuff, and she's invited me to some events that she's some autograph signs, but unfortunately I didn't have the time to meet up with her. But she's very, very nice, but yeah, she's in the belief that Harry was framed and that the government was just looking to pin murders, unsolved murders on Harry. So, I mean, her books, it's interesting to read, to see another side of it, but, I mean, take it for what it's worth, basically. But she is a very nice person, and it's definitely worth checking her book out if you want to hear the good side of a mobster. It's interesting to see from a family's point of view of a guy who so much bad stuff is written about Harry. So it is interesting to see the other side, the family life of a mobster.
Which he was never on the receiving end of that hook that he was known for.
No.
Yeah, exactly. But I think many of her boyfriends came close to it, though, according to her.
You know, he was an interesting, complex guy compared to a lot of these guys who are just brutes. I've known a few of them personally, and they basically are just brutes and more operate off their animal instincts. And outside of watching a sports team winning and losing, that's the most emotion they ever exhibit. And Harry was, you know, he was kind to his children. He spent a lot of time with them. He was an artist. He graduated from an art school in Chicago. What was that name of that school? Does anybody remember the Chicago School of Art? Was that the name of it?
Institute of Art.
Institute of Art.
It was a pretty well-known school, though. I mean, it's a school that's pretty well-respected.
Here it is. It is from the beginning of the notes here from that first episode where we were talking about him growing up there, but it was the Chicago Academy of Fine Arts.
Yeah, and probably
graduated in 58.
Okay, yeah. Shortened to later on was known as the Chicago Art Institute, right? Like we have a Kansas City Art Institute, and it's like the top of the line for art programs.
That's how it is here too.
That's what I figured. But he would go on to become the leader of a home invasion robbery crew, and he was the guy that did took all the enforcement actions for Joe Ferriola. And Joe Ferriola, he decided at one point in his career in the early 70s, he was going to line up all the sports bookies, just like the outfit lined up speakeasies and places that sold booze during Prohibition. And they were all going to be with somebody. You had to be with a crew in order to be a sports bookie, and you had to pay a street tax, just exactly like they did speakeasy operators in the 1920s. Harry was a guy that went out and visited the bookmakers, and there was still a lot of book betting on racetracks, horse racing. You had Arlington out there. You had actually had Sportsman's Park too. I think he had two racetracks just in Chicago alone.
Yep. Yeah. Two of them. Yeah.
And so people still wanted to make off-track bets. He didn't want to go out to the racetrack to make the bet. And so you had wire room operators there in Chicago, and they all had to pay a street tax. But he really developed into a most efficient and cold hitman. We learned from a guy who really was his friend and his driver in one of these hits when he killed Billy Logan. We talked about that he liked hitting his victims in public places. Now that kind of ended up, it's going to end up getting him in trouble with the Billy Logan hit when his friend Louis Alameda, as we talked about before, became a government witness. The outfit had such long arms into the Cook County government that they were able to go in. He was arrested when Louis Alamedia went into witness protection. He testified that he was the one who drove Harry Alaman over to hit Billy Logan. A guy named Bob Lowell was walking the dog up the street to see Billy Logan, and he was standing just a few feet away when Harry Alaman killed him. Both those men testified that they saw Harry Alaman kill him, and he got a not guilty because the outfit was able to reach out to this guy named Robert Cooley and get the case fixed. So that's kind of where we are now. Now, in the 80s, this is at the end of the 80s where we were, but during the 80s, the FBI, the IRS, and the Cook County prosecutor, they must have had a good prosecutor for a while, participated in a joint investigation called Operation Greylord, and that was a three-year-long undercover investigation that exposed corruption and bribery in the Cook County courts. They exposed clerks, judges, police officers. And at the end of Operation Greylord, we were talking about Bob Cooley, or Robert J. Cooley, former Chicago police officer turned lawyer who was the mob's kind of the bag man and the fix-it guy. He went to Robert Cooley if you wanted to get something fixed, and he would find the right judge. He would go to Pat Macy, who was a mob guy and was closely connected to all the Cook County criminal justice people, as well as all the Cook County politicians. And Cooley, he did not get indicted out of Operation Greylord, and we had a long discussion and speculation about why he did this, but he walked into the FBI office and offered to work. Now, he claimed that he just had a guilty conscience. I don't know. Mike said he had a lot of mob debts, several hundred thousand dollars worth maybe, that he was able to walk away from. He claimed that he had seen how successful Operation Greylord was, and he kind of felt guilty about the past use of bribery for the outfit. Here's the one story, you may or may not. You know this story, Mike, about how he felt like he was forced by his mob contacts to bribe a judge to find for a defendant not guilty who was a mob-connected guy, an associate, and he had severely beaten a Chicago policewoman. And he said when he did that and the guy got off, he'd had enough. Do you know anything more about it? I didn't learn anything more about that.
Yeah, that took place in the 80s. It was a kid, he's probably 18 or 19 years old, named Mike Colella. His uncle was kind of connected to the outfit, and he was just a weightlifter, kind of steroid freak. And on New Year's Eve, I believe in 85, he got pulled over on New Year's Eve for going the wrong way in a one-way street. And when the cop pulled, it was a female officer who pulled him over, he jumped out of the car and beat her, literally to the point where she had to have complete facial, almost facial reconstruction surgery on her face. It was that bad of a beating. And according to Cooley, when that case happened, Pat Marcy basically told Cooley, hey, listen, take care of this for us. And Cooley always told Pat Marcy that the one thing he never wanted to be involved with was fixing cases that involved cops. That was because his dad was a cop, he was a former cop, and that was a line that Cooley said that he just didn't want to cross, which is ironic. I mean, Cooley was fixing murder cases, but apparently he just felt very guilty, according to him, about fixing a case that involved a cop getting beat so bad. And in the end, Cooley ended up, you know, Cooley wanted to plead the case out. Cooley talked to the prosecutor and said, hey, what's the best deal we can get? This kid's 18, 19 years old. You know, he's got a whole future ahead of him. He made a big mistake. The kid went to rehab. He got off the steroids he was on. He knows he messed up. You know, let's not go too hard on this kid. And the prosecutor was willing to, work with Cooley on it, saying, I'll go back to my supervisor. And once Pat Marcy got wind of it, Marcy got all upset, saying, no, this case is, you know, we want this case thrown out, basically. This kid's going to walk. And so Cooley was so upset, apparently, you know, that he was forced to, like, you know, do this, that he walked into in March of 1986, he walked into the Strike Force office and asked, you know, hey, as long as there's nothing, no investigations with me involved in it, I'll be willing to help you guys take down the First Ward, which basically was the whole corruption system that the outfit controlled, basically. So, you know, and at that point, then they did a background, you know, the the agent did a search and said, "Hey, we got nothing on you. So what can you tell us?" I mean, the agent later said too, he's like, they knew who Cooley was because he was involved in several high profile cases, but they had no idea about, all the stuff that he ended up, telling them. They really got a big catch that day when Cooley came in.
Yeah, interesting. So, well, I'm glad he did it. I think he probably feels better for it, because
Cooley was probably one of the key in the last 30 years of mob trials in Chicago. Operation Gambit was definitely probably one of the highest or higher profile cases, because I mean, that right there showed the average person who lived in the Chicago area just how corrupt the city was. I mean, that trial pretty much exposed the outfit for everything they were involved in. It really was, when you read Robert Cooley's book, When Corruption Was King, it almost seems like it's unbelievable to see how much they controlled. I mean, the outfit controlled who was the judges, who they assigned police sergeants and police captains. I mean, they were put people in positions of power that took years and years. I mean, Cooley destroyed decades of work that guys like Tony Accardo and Joey Iupa put into, like, corrupting the system. So Cooley was a very, very important witness for the government.
You have something, Aaron?
Oh, no, I just was saying that before he came in, he seemed like the kind of guy strong enough to carry $10,000 in cash about anywhere around town for these guys to bribe people. Judges bribed, cops bribed, bribed to come in and testify in the Billy Logan case. Here, and that suddenly gets a conscience.
Yeah, really, I don't know.
Like, one of the things out of all these Harry Ailman episodes we've done, we never really went through. Gary has a whole page of people that that were murdered. Harry Ailman was involved in it. So,
as we said, and Mike said, that the Chicago cops, any unidentified suspect mob hit, they ended up lumping onto Harry Ailman at the time.
Well, no, I would say I don't doubt that Ailman probably has a pretty good track record of murders, but I don't think that the outfit would use them that prolifically, that often for murders. I mean, the outfit had a team of killers at that time, to do the dirty work, but, obviously Harry was very good at what he did.
Yeah. Anyhow, let's go back on Cooley just a little bit. I was studying up on him, and it seems that his main contact in the outfit, once he got into sports gambling big time and started doing some bribes, was a Marco D'Amico, who was in the Elmwood Park crew, ran a bookmaking and juice loan organization, he ran a bookmaking and juice loan business. It was said that at one point in time, Cooley owned another bookie, $50,000, and D'Amico had somebody intimidate this bookie just to forgive that debt. And now in the end, as I made a note here to myself, no good deed goes unpunished, because Cooley will eventually wear a wire on D'Amico and set him up on robbery, gambling, and extortion conspiracy charges, which then became predicate acts for a RICO charge. He had been involved in not only in carrying bribes around, but in a lot of other things in the sports gambling operation of the Chicago outfit. I think hence the name of the investigation that really focused the investigation was Gambit?
Yeah, correct.
Gambling
attorney.
That was it. Gambling attorney. Gambat. Gambling attorney. That's it. I knew it was. I knew that didn't sound right. Anyhow, so that was just, that was all focused on Cooley. He was, he was the case. Without him, there was no case. There was nothing without him. So when they're debriefing Cooley, he starts talking about they've just got done with Operation Greylord. You'd think that big a 3-year operation, and they had an attorney who they turned early on in that thing who was central. I remember reading that book. And you would think that they had rooted out all the corruption in the Cook County court system after 3 years of working on them, and he comes in and starts telling them about all the people they didn't get.
Yeah, according to Cooley, I mean, his thing was, is like, Graylord got, they got a lot of guys in Graylord, but they didn't touch the first ward. That was the big thing with Cooley, was the first ward was the guys who held all the power in Cook County, and that's what, and Cooley says that's why he was let, he said he was let down by Operation Graylord, because Graylord got, like, you know, they got a couple big fishes, but got a lot of small guys who were just fixing, like, local traffic stuff that, well, yeah, which is still bad, but, I mean, guys like, you know, like the guys Pat Marcy was working with, these were judges who were fixing major murder cases and major, with major outfit figures in them and stuff. So, you know, Cooley wanted to finally put an end to the corruption altogether in Chicago.
Yeah, I kind of remember in Graylord, it seemed like they got one main judge's clerk that was doing a whole lot of stuff, and they got a bunch of policemen, of course. But I don't remember that they got any significant judges, or actually, even maybe they did get a judge or two, but not like these guys did in Gambat. It was, they really took them down. And, you know, one of the first stories that he told them.
Yeah, Gambat really went
Go ahead.
Yeah, Gambat really went after, like, a lot of the key judges. Where Graylord got a lot of the bailiffs and, like, a lot of the court personnel guys who were, like, the backmen for the judges.
Yeah.
And stuff. And they got a few judges, but the judges they got were fixing, like, they weren't fixing murder cases. I mean, they were still fixing cases, which is bad enough, but the guys Cooley ended up going after were guys who were, like, guys who were, like, these were judges who were, had, who were direct outfit associates. These guys were taking orders from, directly from Pat Marcy, basically. And, I mean, it didn't get much higher than that. I mean, outside of that, I can't imagine how much higher they could have got. Once they got to Pat Marcy, who was the first, who was basically, you know, ran the first ward for the outfit, I mean, he was the, there was no one higher than him at that point, at that time, in that whole court, Pat Marcy was the key guy. That's the guy Cooley knew that they needed. If they didn't get Marcy, the case would have been a failure, basically. I mean, they needed Cooley and Fred Rohde and those guys, because those guys were pulling the strings. These judges were just like the pawns in the game, really, because they knew, the whole reason they got their seat as a judge was because Pat Marcy let them get a seat, basically. They paid, Pat Marcy had, you know, took a fee from them for making them judge.
That would give you a lot of power if he was the guy that, the reason that you became a judge, which is a pretty decent job. I don't know what they made back then. A judge makes about
it's not an easy job to get.
Yeah, it makes about $120,000 to $130,000 a year, and you got all kinds of time off, and you got, I've worked for a judge for a summer, and they're just like king in the courtroom, and all these people treat them, you know, with this huge amount of respect. It's kind of almost a phony kind of a deal, but it's you are king in your courtroom, and that's kind of a nice place to be. And everywhere you go, even after I left the clerk job, and I'd run into this judge somewhere else, and even after he quit being a judge, I still couldn't call him by his name. I still had to call him judge. It's pretty well ingrained in us on a judge. So that's that wields a lot of power everywhere. You know, when you're in society, if you're a judge, not only the money you get, but just the respect that everybody gives you, and probably business connections that could be opened up to you, and things like that. So it's a really powerful job to have. And Pat Marcy was the guy that was responsible for getting him that job. I didn't really realize that's quite how it worked.
I'm kind of curious because, you know, here they are talking about Operation Graylord, where they're sweeping in and finding this corruption and charging some lower level folks, bailiffs, right? And with this corruption, do you think that maybe, because those bailiffs, maybe they knew how corrupt the system was, but they had to keep their mouth shut?
You know, they must have, because
how could you not know something else is going on?
They did not give up to any judges.
No.
Did they? Once they came in. I'm not, if they did, I don't know about it. They may have a little bit, but not these judges, not the judges that were connected to the outfit. But,
yeah, like Mike says, the whole first ward stayed.
Right. You probably would be smart enough to not give up any judge that was connected to the first ward, wouldn't you say, Mike?
Oh, definitely. That's why in Graylord, yeah, because guess what? That's what upset Cooley, according to Cooley in Graylord, that, you know, that none of the judges who went down gave up anyone higher than them. They knew better. They knew if they gave any names, if they mentioned the first ward, that it would be a death sentence to these guys.
Well, and that, and what makes me think of with Cooley, and maybe what motivated Cooley, if you know the mob, the outfit, when, if they think that maybe you're going to catch a case, they may kill you.
Yeah, they just think you are.
If they just think that, if they're suspicious, and like they know, what they know is Cooley has got a lot of dirt on him. And anytime you're in that position, it seems like what you get is a bullet. Or you get out, and that's what happened to Cooley. Maybe I'm just, you know, his motivation may have been more than just altruistic to turn these guys in because he was so incensed by this female officer being beaten.
Yeah, really. So Cooley is, the way he reported it, he's called to a meeting at this downtown restaurant we talked about last time, Counselor's Row, and he's going to meet with Pat Marcy. Now, there's another fixer down there named John Darko, and I'm not real familiar with him, but he'd always sit with them, too, and discuss these court cases and other outfit business. Was he more like a what was the deal with Darko?
John Darko was, he was at one time in the 50s, he was the first ward alderman, and he, according to FBI agent Bill Romer, he was a made man in the outfit and a former Capone bodyguard. And he was basically, the thing with John Darko Sr. was he didn't have the brains like Pat Marcy and did and things like that. So Darko kind of like in the 60s, he was busted meeting with Sam Giancana in a restaurant out in the western suburbs by the feds. And that pretty much ended his career as alderman because the outfit knew like there's no way we can have him run again. Because like, according to the feds, that they were grooming John Darko to be, they wanted him to be mayor one day, which obviously was a long shot because, I don't think, even if he never got caught meeting, even looking back at old articles in the 60s, there was always rumors of his outfit connections. But yeah, he was basically a first ward, a former alderman of the first ward, and basically a right-hand man to Pat Marcy. Basically, if Pat Marcy needed something done quickly, he would call John Darko or Fred Rohde, basically, his two top lieutenants, basically.
Interesting. Now, do you remember, Mike, were there any newspaper articles about the a busboy fighting a hidden mic at this table that Pat Marcy sat at?
Yeah, in 1989.
That was after all this, I think.
Going on, Cooley was, yeah, let's actually, yeah, this is Cooley were actually still working undercover at the time. No one, it was in July of 89, and I think he got pulled out in November of 89 when he got exposed and pulled out. And, basically, a busboy was cleaning up the restaurant at night. He found a hidden camera aimed at the booth that Pat Marcy used every day. And according to Robert Cooley, Cooley was upset because the feds didn't warn him at all. They didn't give him a heads up like, hey, we're gonna put a camera in the counselor's row. And Cooley believed that could have put his life in danger, basically, because, you know, which is, I understand Cooley being upset about that because, yeah, I mean, having a camera, obviously, guys like Pat Marcy knew someone must have been talking or someone must have been giving information to the feds if they're putting a camera at the restaurant, and putting wires in. But yeah, July of 89, a busboy found a hidden camera, but nothing came out of it. They were, the newspapers, they wrote it off as just it's just the aftermath of Operation Grey Lord. It's probably left over from the Grey Lord operation.
Interesting.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they were trying to, and I think the feds tried to spin it that way too, like, oh, you know, yeah, it's, you know, they wanted to get as much attention away from a current investigation. So everything, like all the articles I found about that, it just basically says, oh, it's basically just, they're cleaning up the stuff in the Grey Lord investigation. And they had no idea that Cooley was the one who was working with the feds at the time. But that was July of 89, right towards the end of his undercover operation.
So as they debrief him, he tells them a story about a case back in 1977 in which our good friend Harry Aleman is involved. And he said that Pat Marcy called him in and sitting there at that particular table in Counselor's Row restaurant and said that this is a kind of a sensitive case, but it's got to be fixed. And how can we do that? And Cooley said, he told Marcy, he said, this has got to be handled delicately because Harry Aleman's going to draw a ton of attention. He knew that much by now, that anything that happened in this case that wasn't kosher was going to draw a lot of attention. And he knew that he needed to find a judge, and he said, I will try to find a judge, but then they got to put on a decent enough case to try to show that the case could not be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And Cooley picked this judge, Frank Wilson, because he was a pretty close personal friend and had often visited with him. And he knew enough about Wilson's personal finances that he was complaining about how much it was costing him to maintain a country club membership and send his kids to private school. I don't know, I don't think you got any kids, but boy, that private school, I never sent my kids to them, but it can be expensive, $25,000, $30,000 a year.
Oh, I'm sure.
Even back
then.
And plus, Wilson, as we said something about his, how he established himself as a hard-nosed criminal justice oriented judge who had sentenced people to
the electric chair
before, and he had no empathy for criminals. So, you know, who would suspect him? Cooley approaches Wilson at a downtown bar and said that, you know, he's been approached to handle a big murder case. Now, if you had the tapes of this, you probably wouldn't really believe what it was. If you just heard the words, you'd almost have to see the body language and watch the different eye movements and eye contact and how their faces move, because, you know, Cooley had come to him, and I've had these kind of conversations myself with informants, and you say, you know, I got to handle this big murder case. Well, the other guy doesn't say, oh, well, you want to bribe me? So he said...
Yeah, well, according to Cooley, Cooley testified saying that when he first approached Wilson in the bar, he asked Judge Wilson, he goes, I need someone who can handle a case. It's a very important case, but it's a murder case. And Wilson right away goes, let me guess, is it the Elliman case? So even Wilson knew, kind of, I think, I mean, you know, that, I mean, Wilson obviously knew the court system. I mean, he was obviously a judge for a long time at that point, so he knew how corruptible it was. But I think, you know, but Wilson obviously knew what Cooley was going to ask him, but obviously, you know, Wilson wasn't going to come out and say, like, oh, I want this much money, or yes, I'm, you know, according to Cooley, what he said is, like, he kind of said, like, you know, some very important people want this handled, and, you know, I don't want you to say yes or no, I want you to think about it, basically, because if you agree to do this, you can't back out of this. If you back out, we're both dead. It's simple as that, basically. And Wilson thought about it for a few days and stuff, and that's when Cooley mentioned all the problems Wilson was having with money and stuff. And then eventually Wilson came back and I guess Wilson told Cooley, he goes, how's the case? Is it a strong case or a weak case? And according to Cooley, he read the reports and said it's actually kind of a weak case. Besides the bullets they pull it out of, you know. Logan's body, he goes, you know, there's two eyewitnesses. One of them is, you know, Louis Alameda, and obviously he's, they said he'd be easy to break apart on the stand, and that's when they mentioned the other one was Billy Logan, or no, not Bobby Lowe, who saw, claims he saw Harry shoot him, but it was dark out and stuff like that. So he goes, according to Cooley, thought it was a weak case. I, to me, it sounds like a strong case to me, but that's, I mean, I'm not a lawyer though, so I'm not, you know, what do I know? But, you know, but that's what him and, Judge Wilson talked about it. And basically Wilson agreed to do it. And, but he told Cooley, he goes, but, you know, you cannot be on the, you can't be working on Harry's case though. We got to keep ourselves separate from this. From the get go, Wilson and Cooley were actually really smart about keeping distance from each other, because they knew that, you know, there's a lot of press on this case, so they know it was being watched very closely.
Yeah, interesting. You know, that whole eyewitness thing and being dark, and plus,
The witness gave a different testimony in the initial when the police showed up because of the murder, and he didn't want to necessarily be involved. That's understandable.
And the bar is for conviction. It's got to be beyond a shadow of a doubt. And if there's any reason, and the word is actually reasonable doubt, and there could be reasonable doubt. I could see that. Now, it's kind of unlikely set of circumstances when you got the, if you only had one of these witnesses it would definitely be reasonable doubt. But when you got two witnesses that are totally unconnected with each other, that both picked the same guy, and especially one of them was basically a co-conspirator, but you could never act on a co-conspirator's information alone, but you can act on a co-conspirator's information when you have somebody who's not involved at all, then corroborates that testimony. So it should have gone. But there was enough, I'd say, that he could comfortably say that he, you know, there was not beyond a reasonable doubt that they didn't really meet that burden of proof.
Yeah.
And he, you know, and that whole complicated way of getting him on the case after they turned him down, we talked about that before. That's there's another red flag right there, that the defense lawyer turned him down once, and then all of a sudden they wanted him. There's another red flag when you get down to looking into this thing.
Yeah, to me, that's one of the biggest red flags right there. That to me, that would have been like a big no-no. If I was involved in that fixing that case, I would have said we got to find another judge, because that's going to look terrible in the press after the not guilty verdict's announced. I mean, the first thing the press is going to dig up is the fact that Harry's lawyer turned this judge down as to be the judge in the case, and now the judge came back and they were totally fine with having him be the judge then. So yeah, that was very suspicious.
They also ended up changing up lawyers during the middle of all this, and the new lawyer was I can't remember who that was now, but he knew the whole system was corrupt. Well, Frank Whalen, that's right. He was a Chicago Cook County corrupt lawyer, because he meets with Cooley. And Cooley tells him, said, you know, I got Frank Wilson in my pocket. Don't worry about this. Just go through the motions.
Yeah, he said he was just put the case on. And, you know, he was just, as long as you put on a good case, the judge is going to throw this out. But he goes, but try to make it look good, though. Make it look, you know, don't just, you know, go through the motions. Still put on a good case, but, you know, but the judge has it all taken care of. And then, you know, days later, it came out, then Judge Wilson reached out to Cooley saying, hey, Frank Whalen's not pitting out a good case. He goes, the state's case is actually very good. He's like, you know, I'm in a bad spot here. You know, he's like, you said this was an easy throwout case, and it's really not a throwout case. And Cooley warned Judge Wilson, like, well, you agreed to this. You know, this is what you agreed to. You have to throw this out no matter what. So, I mean, from the start of this case, things were already starting to fall apart for Judge Wilson, at least. It was already things looking bad for him.
Plus, the judge, Wilson, was confronted with some facts that they had bribed a neighborhood girl to go into court and testify that she was also a witness to the murder, and that was, she knew Harry Aleman, and that was not him. And so it was, according to what the book, Everybody Pays, the judge says, he stated to Cooley, this is what you give me? They're fucking burying me. I'm going to lose my judgeship over this.
Exactly, yeah. They're going to pay her the same amount of money. The $10,000 is what they gave Judge Wilson, and they were going to give that witness $10,000. And, yeah, he was really upset about that, the fact that he was a judge. He was going to lose his job, basically, over this case, and all for $10,000, which really, even in 1977, that's really not life—that life-changing money. Really, something to think about it.
Yeah,
you know?
For a murder, to get me off of a murder, I'm going to find life-changing money for you if I can.
Well, if he already knew that when the guy goes, tell you the case.
For something that big, I mean,
he already knew it was ailment.
Yeah, definitely. $10,000 seems like a really small amount.
But how is it when Cooley first meets with him, and he's like, well, you know, I can't tell you what the case is. I just need this case fixed. And here's the judge going, oh, is it ailment? The judge must have been at least somewhat familiar with the case. Don't the judges have access to any of that material? Like, I would go back and look, and I'd be like, wait a second. You know, he's got two witnesses. Yeah, one of them was the driver. One of them was just a completely separate guy walking down the street who was a neighbor. That sounds like $20,000 or $30,000. Fix that case.
Well, actually,
yeah, and that's the thing. Yeah, Cooley was ever clear about that. He just basically said the judge, according to Cooley, he said the judge asked him how strong the case was. Basically, you know, I mean, yeah, it does make sense. I mean, if I were the judge and I was going to do a bribe, I would like to do my own research on the case first and find out, you know, what kind of case it was before you. I mean, you're fixing a murder case from a high profile mobster. You know, that's something you don't want to play around with.
But they were so used to getting away with it that they didn't really feel like taking that kind of those kinds of go into that kind, that much effort, it seems to me like.
Yeah, definitely. Especially back then. Yeah, they were fixing cases all the time.
Cooley also claims that he did go back to Pat Marcy and said, you know, that judge is crying the blues about this $10,000. I think we ought to give him a little more than Pat Marcy, being the tightwad mobster that he must be. Said, no, we've made a deal for $10,000. We're not giving him any more. And more will be revealed about that bribe, too.
Oh, yeah. The funny thing about that is the fact that Cooley, like, sympathizes to Judge Wilson's, you know, his, you know, situation. But at the time, Cooley claims in his book that he was making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year illegally through, like, bookmaking and making bets. I didn't see Cooley going and reaching in his pocket and giving Judge Wilson any money out of his own pocket. So obviously, Cooley didn't feel bad enough for Judge Wilson to give him any more money than, I mean, Cooley tries to make Pat Marcy look like the bad guy when Cooley could have easily given Judge Wilson his share of the money or more money out of his pocket if he felt really that bad for him.
And it gets even worse. Cooley would report that to the Bureau that the day the verdict came down, he packed his clothes just in case that came back in guilty. When the not guilty came down, he was happy, and he went immediately to Pat Marcy. Pat Marcy
he
gives him two envelopes. You remember that?
Yep, yeah. He went out and goes, this is for the judge and this is for you.
Yeah.
The envelopes. And the one for the judge with the remaining money, because Cooley gave the judge, I think, $25,000 or $3,000 up front just to tie him into it. And so I think it was like $7,000 for the judge. And then Cooley opened up his envelope and it was like $2,500 in there, which Cooley even thought was really low for fixing a murder case. But Cooley said, he goes, that the outfit was known to be very cheap. You know, they were very, you know, really cheap when it came to that kind of stuff. So, you know, but still, he thought for all the work they did in getting this guy off, you know, if when you think about it now, $10,000 and $2,500 for the guy who arranged the fix, I mean, they got a really good deal. Pat Marcy got a great deal on that one.
Yeah, he did. Although in the end, it wasn't such a big deal or a good deal for him.
it came back to bite him in the ass in the end.
That did. That was probably, it was so egregious, it was so bad that the government really focused on this particular case quite a little bit. You know, fixing a murder case for $10,000. Is something that you got to focus on. Now, Tony Spilotro had one just like it, but I believe he died before they got back around to taking a closer look at that. I'm not sure.
Spilotro was dead. His case, the case that they claimed was fixed was 1983.
Yeah,
that was that Cooley said was fixed, and yet by the time they indicted the judge in that case, Spilotro was dead, and they did. The judge who they claimed fixing it did go to prison though for fixing other cases though, but they were never able to get him for the Spilotro.
So by the end of Operation Gambit, I guess Cooley must have had some sort of a feeling. He was friends. He was decent friends, I think, with this Judge Wilson, as friendly as friends as friends can be, given that your main connection was illegal. It was bribery and. Probably drinking and socializing in Counselor's Row and at parties and stuff.
Figuring out how to fix the case right,
yeah. Being in that kind of dangerous situation together and getting through it. Like, wow, we got through that one. It's kind of like being a policeman and your partners. But so Cooley feels a little bit bad, I guess, because he personally went out to Arizona. Judge Frank Wilson is retired by this point in time and goes out and tells him that we got you. And we want you to come in and testify on this, even though you're going to have to make a deal and you're probably going to go in witness protection. But Wilson couldn't do it. He knew he was done, and I guess he didn't want to do any more. He ends up committing suicide shortly after that visit by Cooley.
Yep. Yeah, you know, I think he shot himself in the head in his backyard.
Yeah.
About a few weeks after Cooley visited him. His family said, I guess, he also was suffering from some illnesses too, so they think it was a combination of the fact that he was ill and the fact with the stress of knowing the fact that he meant to come back to Chicago and testify. I think he just basically that was enough for Frank Wilson to call the day.
Yeah, I don't blame him. He was going to have to do some time. He couldn't have known enough to. They already had enough on everybody else. He would have to done some time. They would not let him out without doing some time.
Oh, exactly.
So in 1997, Harry Edelman gets to go to trial again, double jeopardy. And boy, they cried the blues on that double jeopardy and went back and forth. I'm sure it went up to the appellate court and came back at least once, if not more than once. Because that's a long-held tradition in the American courts, is if you get found not guilty on a criminal charge, you do not have to ever go back and be tried again, no matter what. But in this case, the appellate court ruled that, you know, it was so corrupt, it was so bad that, yeah, you're going to have another trial. And both his witnesses, Bob Lowell and Luis Almeida, are still alive and willing to testify, which is kind of amazing.
But the judge is not.
No, the judge is not. But we don't really need the judge now. You're going to have a court. You remember anything about that? There was, I don't really remember an article about it that you posted. You maybe just missed it.
You had Louis and Bobby Lowe testifying again, and now you have Robert Cooley testifying too, the guy who, you know, basically was the key guy in the fix. So, I mean, at this point, I mean, Edelman was kind of, you know, I mean, what you said, it kind of went back and forth in the court system for a while, and they said the fact that there was a bribe given, there was no jeopardy to begin with in the first case. So that's how they got around the whole double jeopardy, you know, law and stuff, which makes sense when you think about it, because I know Cooley said when he first brought up the fact that they want, you know, that he helped Harry fix the case, even his handlers even said, there's no way we can do this because of double jeopardy. He's like, he was already found not guilty. And they said they tossed it around for a while trying to figure out how could they, and like, I can't remember the lawyer's name or who it was who came up with the argument, but he said, well, hey, if you can prove there's a bribe, then there's no jeopardy, because Harry was aware of it. If Harry was aware there was a bribe, then we can retry him on this case, because there was never any jeopardy of him being guilty. Which, which when we think about it, it's actually a pretty basic argument, but it's a basic argument to a very complicated case. And obviously, and once Harry was, reindicted for the murder, I think Harry even knew that his days were numbered. You know, he was already sitting in prison, serving out his sentence for the extortion charges for extorting bookmakers, and that's when he was reindicted then for this. So yeah, September of 97, he went and stood trial second time for the murder of Billy Logan.
You know, and their one of their main defenses was, after they lost the appellate argument on whether jeopardy attached or not, and actually were going to have to go to trial, and it was not going to be double jeopardy, was that Butch, his old friend Butch Petroselli, did it, who conveniently, Butch Petroselli is dead by this point in time. So his new lawyers suggest that he's the one that actually did it, and they call a witness who is Billy Logan's ex-wife. And she said that 6 months before Billy Logan was murdered, Logan was involved in a fistfight with Petroselli, and Petroselli had threatened to kill Logan. But apparently that didn't work.
Yep.
That defense did not work. Do you know why Petroselli was killed?
Petroselli was killed because when Harry was in prison, and when Harry went to prison in the late 70s for running the burglary ring, Butch Petroselli was basically, he was in charge of doing all the collections. So since him and Harry were technically kind of partners, so he was making all the collections, and all the money that was supposed to go, so I guess at the time, a percentage of all the money was supposed to go to Harry's family while Harry was in prison. And apparently, Butch was skimming off the top. Skimming money from that. And also, there was a completely unrelated thing, that there was a mob murder, a mobster that was murdered under false information by Butch Petroselli. Because Butch was jealous of this other mobster, so it was a combination of Butch stealing money and then also conspiring to have another mobster killed. And finally, they got the okay from Angelo LaPietra, who was the boss of the Chinatown crew, and Nick Calabrese and Frank Calabrese Senior and that crew. They're the ones who actually killed Butch Petroselli, and he was killed in, I believe, around December of 1980. He disappeared. And then they found his body in March of 1981 in a parked car in the south side of Chicago.
Oh, really? Is he the one that they burnt with a blowtorch, it looks like?
Yeah, after they killed him, Angelo LaPietra, he was nervous that he wasn't dead. He was afraid that they didn't finish him off. So he ordered Nick and Frank Calabrese to go back to where the car was at, and he wanted them to set the car on fire. So he rolled the windows down and poured gasoline, you know, like a canister of gasoline in, and they threw a match in and rolled the windows up, but they didn't realize that once all the oxygen was done, yeah. the fire would flame itself out.
Yeah.
So he basically partially burnt his face.
Oh,
and
okay.
If you see the crime scene, if you see the autopsy photos, you can see exactly where they put the duct tape over his mouth. So when they tortured him, they put duct tape over his mouth when they were strangling him. And it's kind of weird because he's like, his whole face is burnt black, but besides his mouth, and that's, you know, his mouth looks perfectly normal, but the rest of his face was completely disfigured.
All right. I get it now. Huh.
Because he actually died at the hands of Frank Calabrese, Sr. with the famous Calabrese.
Yeah, Frank Calabrese Sr. was the one who killed him.
With a Calabrese necktie.
And that came out during the Family Secrets trial.
That's what I figured. Did he cut his throat and shoot him? And then they still weren't worried. Or still worried
think,
he wasn't dead.
I think they slit his throat, and they strangled him first, and then after he was dead, Frank Calabrese Sr. still slit his throat just to make sure that he was dead.
Yeah. Yeah, Frank Jr. told us about the Calabrese necktie. Man, that was some cold people, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, and I don't necessarily know that I would argue with Angela the Hook either when he said go back and just make sure.
Really?
Make sure. Like, you double made sure, but I want to make sure again.
I guess better safe than sorry. You know,
yeah, really.
What happens when you don't get the job right.
A few years later, then. So, you know, I guess, I mean, maybe Angela wasn't, I mean, maybe it was good that Angela was a little more nervous because, I mean, yeah, I think it was like, 2 years later, Ken Ito was shot 3 times, and look what happened to him. He survived.
And
look what happened to the guys that shot him.
Yeah, and then they got killed.
Yeah, they ended up dead then. Yeah, exactly. So,
and it brings us back around to loading your own rounds.
Yeah. Plus, when you don't get them killed and they know a lot of secrets, then they end up like Ken Ito and Jimmy Fratiano. They trotted those guys everywhere. These Chicago mob guys were on trial. They would trot them out and have them testify that there was an outfit and this was who was in it and this was how it lined up and this was how they were connected together in order to help make that RICO charge. So that's you do not want to leave anybody alive in that world, do you?
No, not at all.
We've actually got a copy of an affidavit that Ito signed where he names, and it's really no new information, but he names, you know, Iupa being the boss and each one of the mob people that were being tried in the skim trial and what their position was in the organization. And then they would take him to trial, and then he would go over the affidavit and say, you know, is this your affidavit? Is this your signature? And did you sign this? And, you know, so they could put it in as evidence. Kind of a little known fact about the skimming trial that happened here in Kansas City. So, well, I think we're about done. Aleman gets convicted. He gets 100. I never heard of a sentence quite like this. 100 to 300 years in jail. And this is the only time that anybody's ever been tried twice for the same murder. Although, you know, we did have a guest here that was tried twice for the same bank robbery. But that was because one was in federal and one was in state court. He cop pleas in state court.
Okay.
I mean, in federal court, he cop pleas, got 6 years. And then the state prosecutor, because he was good for headlines, he was known as the Boonie Hat Bandit, and he decided he was going to try him in state court. And there's a little-known law that really isn't in every state that allows a state to try somebody for state law violation even after they've been convicted of a violation of federal law for the exact same crime. I'd never heard of that before.
Yeah.
That poor guy got like 20 years from state court, and he only got, what did he get, Aaron, 6 or 7 in city, I mean,
in
federal court. He's done all of his federal time, and he's still sitting up there at Cameron in the penitentiary waiting for the rest of the, I think he's got about 7 more years to go before he can get out.
Yeah, they released him from the federal prison so they could take him right to the state prison.
Yeah, actually, he never even went into a federal prison. They just, since he got the state conviction, they just put him in the state and put a federal detainer on him in case the state let him out. So it's he's a hard luck dude. I tell you, they're trying to get the governor, who's got all kinds of trouble anyhow, to pardon him, but I don't think, or commute his sentence rather, but I don't think they're going to get it done.
Not unless he can come forward as some sort of witness for the governor.
Yeah, really. If he'd witness for the governor, he'd say, yeah, the governor didn't take that picture of that naked girl.
He did not try to blackmail her.
He did not try to blackmail that naked girl he was having an affair with. Oh, well, so, Mike, this has been great. I don't know. You got anything else to add? I see in my notes here, since I've got it written down specifically, Harry Alleman, he said of his sentence, serial killers get that. I cause no problems for anybody. I'm no threat to anybody.
Yeah, and then he ended up passing away in 2010. He ended up passing away of, I want to say cancer, but I don't know exactly what kind of cancer he had, but... Yeah, I believe it was around May of 2010, Harry died in prison.
Yeah, you got it. He was 71. It was a prison in Galesburg, Illinois, the Hill Correctional Center.
Yep, that's right, yeah. Wow. Cause, well, yeah, once he finished serving his sentence for the extortion charges, then he had to start serving his...
His 100
for his murder conviction. Then.
His conviction
300 years for
that conviction. That even serial killers don't get that. That's an interesting comment on your sentence.
Here's, I know that. Yeah, that's. I know a lot of serial killers got life. I mean, I guess 100 to 300 years technically is a life sentence. But I guess with parole, I guess it depends on the parole. The parole restrictions. I guess whatever.
Yeah.
But still, 100 years is life. To me, that's life, to me, at least. I mean, I guess it depends on how you look at it.
How do they say 100 to 300?
Yeah, I think Harry was just trying to...
Yeah, I don't know.
How do they say 100
to 300?
100 to 300. So, like, I guess if your sentence gets, reduced for good behavior, that's a lot. 200 years of good behavior is a lot.
Yeah.
Just saying. Here, according to Wikipedia...
I think the reason why he got that odd sentence, though, because... He had to be sentenced under the 1977 laws.
Oh, interesting. So yeah, he would have.
Even the 97 trial, and I think that's why he wasn't given life. Because I mean, maybe whatever the laws were at that time, that's the maximum sentence he could have got. Because normally they just give guys life sentences normally for crimes like that.
Yeah.
At least in Illinois they do. But I think in that case, though, they had to go by what the laws in 1972 or 1977, whenever the murder or whenever the first trial took place.
Yeah.
I think they had to go by whatever laws that were there.
And actually, that's what we call an indeterminate sentence. I wasn't really thinking about that until we started talking about it. And they used to do those a lot, and correctional people that study corrections and everything started legislating against that, and legislatures did end up with determined sentences, and they can be pretty egregious at times, and like a crime of violence with a weapon, you have to do 80 or 85% of it many times, but they quit doing those indeterminate sentences like that, like 10 to 20 or 100 to 300, and that was pretty common back then, and they did that in order to help the prison system, they said. So if you got in trouble in prison, then they could go back and look at that and say, well, you still got another 200 years to go, and you've been a kind of a pain in the butt here, so you're going to just keep on serving it. Or if you got 10 to 20 years, if you were good in prison, then you could start trying to get out at 10 years. But you might have to go clear to 20, kind of depend on your conduct in prison, but they quit doing that because people complained so much about, you didn't know when you were going to get out.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I saw here, this was according to the Wikipedia on Harry Alleman. He died of complications from lung cancer, which he'd been battling for years, and it says on May 15th of 2010 at the Hill Correctional Center in Galesburg, Illinois. Here it says he was buried in the Waldheim Cemetery in Forest Hills, Illinois.
Yeah. Is that in Chicago?
Probably some other famous mob folks
buried
there?
Yeah, it's in the suburb of Chicago. Yeah, it's just the outskirts of the city.
Interesting. All right. Well, I think I've said all I can possibly say about Harry Alleman. I'm I'm excited about having a whole Chicago month here in a couple of months. We'll be amping this up as we get closer. Mike, it's been great having you on here. You saved me. I mean, I did a lot of research on this, but you really got the details down. You had more details than I did, and I think I liked it, and I think you do too. You like to let people know the details and how this stuff really worked, and you got them down. I really appreciate your coming on.
Oh, thank
this.
You very much. Thanks, Doug.
We're gonna do
some
more with
thanks
you.
Thanks for having me on. I love coming on.
Well, and we want to make sure that fans of Gangland Wire know to follow you on the Facebook. You're at the Chicago Outfit old and current news articles.
Correct.
Yeah, be sure and do that, folks. It's a great Facebook page. You'll learn more about the Chicago Outfit than you ever wanted to know. You know, one thing, one of the ones I like, it's on there, and you may not even remember that you put it up. There's one where Joey Iupa, when he was younger, was going to bribe a Cook County vice detective, and he was wearing a wire, and they printed the transcript of Iupa talking to him. Now, of course, back then, it didn't go anywhere, but it's really, I liked reading that transcript of that bribery attempt and the language that they used.
Oh, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know what, I'll repost that again. I'll go back tonight, actually, and dig that
all
up
right.
again. I know exactly which one you're talking about, actually.
Yeah, I like that because we like that out of the mouths of the men that did it. And that's, you know, that is the language that they used of corruption. You know, we can talk about it till we're green in the face, but you know, we're not really involved in it. We're not really there. But when you see, you know, how that works and how they tried to corrupt that policeman, how subtle it was, and I can't remember what it was, but it was very subtle, and he really tried to make it easy for the guy to just start taking a little bit of money because he knew once he got him on the hook for a little bit, he had him for all.
Oh, yeah.
All right. I'll go ahead and let Mike sign off and get out of here and go on about his business, and we'll end up with our public service announcement. Do you have anything else you want to ask Mike, Aaron?
No, I'm trying to think of a good, you know, a great Harry Ailman anecdotal story, but, you know, you haven't gone out to that cemetery. If you do, it'd be great to take a photo of his. It may be on Find a Grave.
It'll probably be on Find a Grave. I've never done that. I'll take a look at that.
All right. I don't know. I'm sure it might be, but yeah, I'm sure I can find. So, because there's people in my group who take a lot of photos like that of grave sites and stuff. So I'm sure I could probably, you know, I hate to use the term dig up a photo for
right.
Site, but I'm sure I could probably find a photo of Harry's tombstone.
Well, it would definitely be if we did the tour of Chicago
really?
On that tour stops.
Really? Hey, Mike, one other question I have. What's your favorite neighborhood restaurant in your neighborhood?
Oh, I'd probably go with Coal Fire Pizza. It's actually, I live in the building of actually the pizza place that occupies it. It's a really good pizza place, and they like make calzone, salad, and pizza.
Okay.
It's a really, really good restaurant.
Sounds good. If we ever get up there, we're gonna take you out for that restaurant for
a coal-fired pizza.
For a coal-fired pizza, Mike.
That sounds great. Yeah, I'd love it if you guys came out. Definitely come on out anytime.
All right, Mike. It's been great talking to you. Good night.
Good talking to you guys, too.
All right, Aaron, that's been great. The final episode of our four-part series on Harry Ailman, and we learned a lot about the Chicago Outfit and corruption in Cook County and the Cook County courts. You see why I chose that, because it really goes across the board of mob activity from sports gambling to murder to extortion to
corruption,
home invasion, robberies and high-end burglaries to corrupt politicians. It's totally across the board, and he went all the way across the board.
He might have been a really great commercial artist if his father hadn't beat him so much.
Yeah, plus he was an interesting guy. I mean, more of a complex kind of a guy than a lot of these guys. That's another thing that drew me to Harry Ailman. All right. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase or rent on Amazon. And then after you're done watching that and you're going to want to know more, you want to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can take your own turn-by-turn directions to notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And if that doesn't pique your interest, you're going to want to get Gary's latest book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination in Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, and it's an even better Kindle because Gary has taken the actual audio and transcribed it in the book and the video that's available in the Kindle book. When you click on a hyperlink, you can actually listen to the words from the mouth of the men that did it.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Automatic. Follow them on Facebook at Automatic Music. You know, I was going to say, and maybe it's better in the kind of the break segment here if you don't put this in. Mike, if you go back to Wikipedia, usually if there's been a page established that somebody has written something on, you can, if you're logged in or not, but you can go back to previous versions of that page and it will show you how it appeared.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This guy.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, go do that, and you can go back and kind of look at the history of the page as people add to it, and you can see older versions of whatever that page was. So, I was gonna say that in the episode. But apparently the secret word for this episode is coolie. See if Gary leaves that in. Hold on, I'll bring Gary up.
Be something we could put in at the end of the episode here.
If you really want to know where Cooley lives, you're going to have to listen to us talk about how I tell people that they could actually find it by...
Now, how do you do that, Aaron? Say that
if you
again.
Go to Wikipedia.
And what?
And there's
what?
Like a page history. When someone creates a page
and
then they edit the page, there's a history there, and you can go and look at various revisions of Wikipedia page.
I never noticed
that. So I imagine that if there was an address or other information that somebody maybe took out, that if you looked at one of the older versions of the page, it would still be there.
Oh, interesting. All right, let's
check that out.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping I'm right. I mean, I've done this before on Wikipedia where I've gone and looked at the history of a page revision and found different information. Maybe we get Cooley to come out.
Yeah, really. Maybe if we could find Cooley. I did try to
I'm
find
the restroom real quick.
Okay, he's got to run the bathroom. I did try to find the FBI agent that brought him in, a guy named Terrence Hake. I had a connection with an FBI agent that knew him or knew somebody that knew him or something, and they were going to send him the message and see if I couldn't get him to do a call-in show about Cooley. That would be good, but I've never heard from him. I'd forgotten I'd even did that until I'm looking back at my notes. I was going to say that in the but now I realize that guy's never gotten a hold of me. So you never know about these deals. I'll go back to my connection and see where we're at on that, if she had ever done it or what the deal was. All these FBI agents have their phone numbers and contact information in the retired agents directory. And Bill Owsley, our oftentimes contributor here that comes in, he'll help me find FBI agents to see if I can get them to come on my podcast. Most of them got some kind of a book to sell, so they're happy to come out and do stuff like this.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm thinking about that. Aaron was on me one other time to try to go up and do some kind of a meetup in Chicago, and I kind of, I don't know, I wasn't in the mood at the time. But I'm doing less other work and not so busy now, so I may think about putting something like that together.
It's a hard thing to do because it's like when you try to do those things, you get people saying, I wish you did it this day. I can't make this day.
Yeah,
and
I know.
Just, you know, it's hard. It's almost like a full time job to be able to
do it. It is.
To do an event.
Yeah.
You gotta find a location, and then you gotta promote it, and then people, are bitching because it's too far, or why can't you do it this day? It's almost to the point where it's like, is it really worth it? It is worth it in the end, but yeah, it is a lot of work though.
Yeah. I don't think we've.
But it's a good idea, though. I mean, it'd be fun. I mean, I'd be willing to help out and do it.
Yeah.
I think it could be a really fun thing to do. But yeah. I mean, something like that. I mean, it definitely takes some planning. That's for sure.
It would, and it would take some outlay of cash. I think I would definitely want to charge something for it. I believe that people value things more if they have to pay something anyhow, as opposed to if it's just free.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So I don't know. We'll talk about that over the next few months. I don't foresee anything this summer, next winter or next late fall. Maybe it'd be the earliest I'd want to do something. I'm kind of going to dug off this summer a little bit and take some time away. I've got a bunch of podcasts in the can, and sometimes you just need a break.
Going to get some more in Vegas.
Yeah.
We'll get some more in Vegas. We got a guy, this Robert Andretti, I can't pronounce, Andracci or something. He's a former Illinois state investigator that did a mob thing, investigation and gambling in a suburban Chicago area. He's got a pretty good story to tell. I'd like to get that gal, that Lefty Rosenthal's gal, to sit down and do a podcast for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to think. Seemed like there was somebody else that was going to be
Finno.
Out there. Oh, Ronald Finno. I'll do one with him out there. He's a really, you don't know him. He's a really interesting, great storyteller. He's got a book called The Triangle Exit. He was, his dad was a Buffalo, New York mob guy, and he was in a labor union as a job as a younger man. And of course, he was loosely connected because of his father, and he ended up, I don't remember the exact detail, but he ended up actually working for the FBI and then maybe the CIA after that for years as a contract agent and going in and doing things. And this guy, he is a dynamic dude, and I could see where he could do it. I did a program with him before out there at the Mob Summit, and he really totally overshadowed me because he had such great stories. And I mean, he's all the way up to talking about selling guns to Al-Qaeda and later in his career. So he's a good dude, and we want to get him talking about his career. I just have never done it. Now that he's going to be out there, we'll get him. So anyhow, let's go ahead and start this. Do you want to start it? You want to just go from dead stop here?
I got it queued here.
Right? Okay, he's going to bring down the mics and cue back up the music and go back in, Mike.